Welcome to another thrilling episode of Strange Library Podcast. My name's Leroy.
My name is Aiden.
And this episode, we are doing H.P. Lovecraft's The Color Out of Space, our first Lovecraft story. How do you feel about it, Aiden?
We're finally getting to the Lovecraftian horrors, which are so inspired the idea of a strange library.
We have mentioned them almost every episode, and I believe this is your first Lovecraft story that you've ever read.
Yes, this is my first Lovecraft story that I've ever read. Absolutely.
I'm going to say you kind of picked a banger. It's a good one.
It's very cool. It is very cool. Yeah.
Lovecraft is known for his purple prose, and Lovecraft is also known for not being a particularly good writer, but I think this one actually betrays that. I think he's actually well written in this. What do you think?
Yeah, I got to agree. I'm surprised that he's not known for being a good writer, because this one was very nicely written and there were some really nice sentences in it. And there were some very clever workarounds that we'll get to later on that I was very impressed by.
Workarounds, how workmanlike, which is not something that you get from a foppish New English ex-aristocrat. So this is Color Out of Space. I love this one. It's got some great weird, I mean, yes, weird fiction, but it's got some great kind of like twisting landscapes and strange monsters. I mean, you know, you come to Lovecraft, you think of mouths and tentacles and kind of otherworldly beasts, but this is literally a radioactive color.
It's very abstract, and it's a lot more quiet than I expected a Lovecraftian story to be.
Yeah, abstract is the word that I was straining to get to there. But yeah, it's not just in the name, it's an odd beast. This was written in March of 1927. It was released in September of 1927.
Mm-hmm.
And then he died not long after that.
Yes.
And the first nuclear experiment was done in 1945. Now, to call this like a nuclear parallel would be to take away from its weirdness. But it feels oddly prescient of what nuclear fallout would feel like.
Yes. Yes, that is a very good point, and that hadn't come to mind.
Yeah, I don't want to take away from the weirdness, because it is weird, but it is almost kind of like a... What happens in this story almost feels like radiation sickness if it was done by some kind of mad outside god.
Yeah, well, let's go through the synopsis and then we'll discuss exactly
I'm getting excited and getting ahead of myself. Let's go through the story. We're just going to run through the points so that you guys can follow along, because let's be honest, you didn't read it.
And
even though you should.
You should, because this is a synopsis that I whipped up very quickly, and it is not indicative of the brilliance that is this story, so you should definitely read it and then come back.
We will put a link in the show notes. There is a great hour and 20 minute audio version on YouTube that does an amazing job. You should listen to that at the very least. It's a good hour.
It is a very good hour, and it saved my life when reading this story.
Yeah, I think I used it to brush up and didn't use it to replace reading it whatsoever.
West of Arkham, there is a place which is ostensibly haunted, bereft of any folk. Army is the only person left in this area, near the blasted heath. This place is to become a reservoir.
Our unnamed protagonist observed the way everything was decaying, all the buildings collapsing and plant life overgrown. He is told not to bother with Army, so he goes to him and asks what's happened.
After being told a wild tale of the blasted heath, he returns to the city and hands in his resignation.
A while later, the reservoir was being developed, and our unnamed protagonist recalls what Army told him.
In the 80s, a meteor struck the town, landing near Nahum Gardner's place. The meteor was analyzed by members of the university extensively, and they found that it was not solid, but more plastic and malleable, with strange properties that resulted in it constantly shrinking, burning up the items around it, and being almost completely indestructible.
The scientists conduct numerous tests before concluding that it must be indeed alien. It emitted bands of light that have never been seen before, and when the scientists returned to the meteor, there was revealed within a strange globule the same alien light bands streaking across. The scientists struck the globule and it burst. The scientists took the remaining lumps and studied them more.
There was soon a storm, and the meteor attracted lightning to it, being struck 6 times and scorching the earth, utterly destroying the meteor in the process.
All was well, with the tale spreading even to Boston, until times of the harvest. The fruits were luscious and brilliant, but had bitter, vile taste that lingered on the tongue. Then came the winter, and the Nam family began to withdraw from society and look more haggard and worried.
In the snow, there were strange prints being discovered, and Ami witnessed a rabbit that bounded far further than a rabbit should, while young men found a woodchuck with a strange, screaming face. Similarly, the plants seemed to be growing ominously, and the trees near the Nahum house were seen to move without wind. Then they began to faintly glow.
The plant life began to turn grey. While talks of Naim's wife and son's madness began to grow, soon all the plant life was crumbling to powder, and the well water became tainted, the livestock became grey and died, and Naim's youngest son also began to madden.
His eldest died first, before his youngest vanished, leaving behind his melted, tangled lantern near the tainted well. Nahum himself began to lose his mind, and when Ami visited to check on him, he found the man babbling that his middle son lived in the well, having also vanished. Upon investigating Nahum's wife, locked in the attic, he found an indescribable lump illuminated by the alien colours, the thing slowly moving as it crumbled like the plants had done. Nahum too began to descend into a grey, crumbling lump, barely able to talk as its mouth caved in.
The police were called to the house, and samples of Naim's family were taken, and the well emptied. The grey remains and depths of the well both emitted strange colour out of space. Ami and the men huddled in the house as the light came from the well, afraid that it may take their lives as it had Naim's.
The plants and trees began to spasm in the windless night, and the alien light began to shine from the tips of the trees, while the same light began to flow from the well and rise into the sky, and Ami's horse screamed an unearthly scream before collapsing.
The farm, the trees, and finally the house began to glow. Ami and the men fled the house. The whole property glowed before the light rushed from the well and disappeared through the clouds. The farm erupted in alien sparks before becoming completely lightless.
Fleeing the entire place, Ami glanced back and saw the faint alien color lift from the well, then sink again, still lurking in its depths.
Our unnamed protagonist describes how he was unsettled by the way the light seemed to change hue around the well, and how he would never drink its water, though he would check on Ami, if only to ensure that he had not become a grey monstrosity. I mean, even listening back to this synopsis, it does not do the credit of how creepy some of this story is.
Oh, this story is so creepy. I had to cut down so much. It was like, it just so much happens in a very brief amount of time, and it's described wonderfully.
Yeah, and it has this old, it's not an epistolary like Dracula. It's not told through letters, but it has this 4 or 5 people removed kind of quality that I'm not sure if that has a name. Do you know?
I think it's called fourth person. So
yeah,
it's a first person perspective telling the story of another person's perspective in third person, and I believe that's fourth person.
Okay, it's the Nahum family that all this happens to. Ami is a neighbor that witnesses it happening, and then our protagonist, the actual author, is a person who is I believe he's a census taker, who is there to take numbers before they flood the entire area and turn it into a dam, which is not a good idea.
No.
The census taker who is talking to the neighbor, Ami, who is telling him about the story of the Nahums, and it's so odd. We would never write a story like this anymore, and I wonder why they were so drawn to it before.
It's a very Shakespearean style of writing, honestly. That's one of the things Shakespeare was famous for, was writing about the person who spoke of the lad who spoke of the small ferret that spoke of the, that's very much his style as well.
Well, speaking of Shakespeare, we do have the Blasted Heath, which is mentioned quite a lot. He describes the area as the Blasted Heath, and I think he even mentions the Shakespeare, not by name, but I think he calls him the Bard?
Yes.
Or maybe the Poet?
I do remember the Bard.
Yeah, he actually says the Poet.
Poet, okay.
Yeah. Yes, so he mentions Shakespeare, not by name, but he does refer to him as the Poet. It was as if the poet had coined the phrase from having seen this one particular region. So, I mean, this is, for lack of a better term, an area irradiated by a Lovecraftian... It's not even a monster. It's just a thing.
This thing, interestingly, reminded me of the Tunguska event, yes, which was in 1908.
Yeah, and Tunguska, I'm not sure how to pronounce it.
And that was when an enormous explosion happened over Russia, which is believed to have been a meteor about the size of a bowling ball, basically going off. But no one's entirely sure if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it's one of those things that have been entered into kind of pop culture or into lore, into the world's lore, where any story that you want to tell, if you can tie it to either the Tunguska event or the Roanoke, where the American settlement disappeared. Do you know about this one, Croatan?
Oh, I don't think I do.
So, I mean, again, I'm going to get this horribly wrong, but this is the fun of folk stories that get told and retold and told wrong. But apparently there was one of the early American settlements, and over a particularly harsh winter, they disappeared. And the only thing that was left is the word Croatan written on a tree. Actually, a little bit off topic, but Neil Gaiman wrote a Marvel comic in which it was called 1608.
Yes, I know 1608.
Have you read it?
I know of it. I've never read it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so that is about time-traveling Captain America finding that American settlement and deciding he wants to help them survive instead of letting them die.
Ah.
But accidentally ruining everything.
Wow. That's cool. Yeah. The description of the blasted heath reminded me of that. It's sort of this image of this completely desolate sort of grey area that sort of looks like it's basically just been exploded.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the first time I read the trees moving on their own, and at first I just kind of breezed over it, and then it took a while to sink in of just the idea of trees swaying without wind. I've just got this very clear visual in my mind of them kind of like swaying together like fingers. And I don't think I realized how creepy trees were until then. Because if you were to describe it to somebody, if you had some kind of sterile future in which we all lived in like carbon fiber walls and everything was that, imagine explaining to something, yeah, there's these things, there's these green seeds that land in the ground, and wherever they land, they'll sprout up this not skin and not hair. And it will grow everywhere. That sounds terrifying.
Yeah. Plants are weird.
Yeah, trees are weird.
I thought as well it was fascinating because at the end it describes how the light picks up and the tree starts shaking, the wind is howling. And I thought it was interesting because it basically describes auditory overload, because you have these people trapped in this house and things start to rumble and things start to shake and then there's lights flashing and things going, and it's like, It's pretty classic sort of auditory torture almost, where it becomes so overwhelming and it just slowly amps up and amps up and amps up. I thought that was quite cool the way he sort of describes this thing.
Okay, so this story is difficult to convey in plot points, but for those that haven't latched on, basically this meteor lands on the family farm. It stays for a while. The scientists think they've picked it up, but it's kind of like this malleable, globule, plastic liquid that emits colours that we can't quite see. It takes a while, but it drains the life out of the land and starts basically mutating the life around it until the point where the family, like, gets sucked up by it. And then once it's all sucked up, it shoots itself back off into space. But the scene that it's describing when Army comes back with the police to check on the dead family, and it gathers up all of its strength to shoot itself back off into space. The auditory overload that you just described, you're also basically describing every scene in a UFO like abduction thing as well. Like lights pouring through the windows, blaring sound and wind and howling, stuff like that. This story is kind of a bit prescient, isn't it?
It really is in a strange way. There's a couple of bits in it that I found fascinating. It's funny. So I mentioned that he doesn't so much cut corners, but he takes...
Workmanlike.
Yes, workmanlike.
Yeah.
And it was because a couple of points, he describes something as indescribable and then leaves it.
Oh, he does it. He does that.
Yeah. And I thought that was very... It was amusing because it worked. He said this, like, he talks about Nahum becoming this indescribable mass. And it's like, okay. And then that's it. It's indescribable. And the color is indescribable. And it's like, huh. It's an effective way, because it's all first person, because it's all subjective. It was actually a slightly, fairly effective way, I found, to get around having to describe and therefore take away the magic of the indescribable.
Yeah, I mean, even though it is, they keep describing the color as one that we don't have basically the sight for, which kind of means that it will just come out looking like other colors to us. I don't think they quite understood how rods and cones worked then, but it's hard not to see it as a purple green kind of like shimmer to me. How do you see it?
Light blue with a sort
light
of
blue.
Light blue. Ooh. With an aqua tint along the edge.
Okay. Yeah, I definitely saw purple greens.
Well, but interestingly, so at the end, the trees end up with lights on the tips of their branches, and all the trees are lit up, and I imagine that is orange.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely orange. A lot of people, when I say that I run a weird fiction podcast, they go, "Oh yeah, I love weird fiction," and I have to be the guy that's like, look, I appreciate the enthusiasm, but weird fiction is actually kind of a genre. It's its own thing. It's not just fiction that is weird. What a lot of people don't understand is that this was sci-fi and horror and fantasy before those titles really had a whole lot of meaning. And when we have the sci-fi of the 1950s, that kind of really solidified these ideas. Aliens come in spaceships, you know, that kind of stayed in the zeitgeist, but this was before that. So the idea of like alien life is actually something that probably doesn't travel in spaceships. It's something that just moves through space on its own accord. I think even another Lovecraft story, the Elder Things, are just things that survive in the vacuum of space, and they just move themselves. They don't have ships. And it's such a cool alien concept that we got locked down in the 50s and have stayed there, and it's really great to see it breaking out of that now. We're starting to get some weird fiction come back into the oeuvre, like I said before, with Annihilation and stuff like that.
It's interesting because I think that some of it is prescient, like the fact that it describes this very sort of nuclear almost wasteland and the effects that it would have on animals and people. But I was just having a look. War of the Worlds came out about 10 to 15 years before this.
Yep. Did they have spaceships in War of the Worlds?
Yeah, because that was the green flares that came from Mars.
Yeah, okay.
And sorry, it was more than 10, 15 years. This is, sorry, War of the Worlds was 95 to 97. And...
18.
Yeah, 1895 to 97 years.
Yeah.
And I think that would definitely have informed this, because this is much more ominous. War of the Worlds is distinct. It comes from Mars. It's that sort of thing. Whereas this is much more of a ominous, where did it come from? Where did it go? I didn't necessarily interpret it as aliens as much as like almost a bacteria or disease.
Yeah, so I interpret it as an alien life form. Not necessarily like a sentient one. Just like a bacteria or a disease. It's just from out.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just different life.
Well, it's terraforming, because it sort of comes down, takes the energy, and it makes everything luscious for a moment, but then evidently, whatever Earth is made of, the things on Earth are made of, isn't enough to sort of facilitate this new thing, and therefore it all collapses.
Maybe this is its propulsion system. It just lands where it can, sucks up the energy and shoots itself off to the next place?
Perhaps, yeah. Yeah. I wonder as well, the implication, because it's implied that the well has something living in it. and that the well is the root of all of the evils, that whatever it is that was in the meteor slunk itself over to the well and sat in there.
Yeah, like the colour lived in the well. Yeah.
Yeah. So I wonder if the implication is that when they make a reservoir out of that area, that the well will infect all of the water.
Oh, yeah, 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 absolutely. Yeah. The water is sucked of nutrients. The whole land is just eating crumbling dirt. There's nothing sustainable in it.
But those who drink the water also go mad.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I guess the implication at the end is that all of Arkham is going to go mad and become grey, desolate sort of horror because of this reservoir.
So if this is your first Lovecraft story, Arkham is a fictional town that's in the Boston, Massachusetts, Providence area of New England. I'm sure you've all heard of Arkham Asylum in the Batman stories. That comes from this Lovecraft reference, Arkham the town. And Arkham University, which is where a lot of Lovecraft stories are kind of like based around, because our heroes are usually academics.
I did not know that.
Which part didn't you know?
Pretty much all of that, as it happens.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. Cool. So when you read Arkham, did you think, oh, that's weird. Like, that's a Batman thing.
When I read Arkham, I thought, huh, I didn't realize there was a place in America called Arkham. That makes sense. I understand that. That would make sense as to why there's Batman's place is called Arkham. It's like, oh, okay. I just sort of figured, look, there's a lot of small American towns with weird names. Like, there's a lot of small Australian towns with weird names. So I was like, okay, I'll go with that. I didn't investigate it at all. Probably should have.
Well, the university's called Miskatonic University, and I have my fair share of fake, like, university t-shirts from Miskatonic.
Nice.
And as the weirdo that I am, I do get asked about it, and you know, eventually I just say, look, don't worry about it, it's from a book, don't worry about it. Because I just come off sounding stupid and pretentious. Which is why I do the podcast where I can explain it, and people came for the explanation, so it's fine.
I found this story was very, say, ominous, because it's very slow and it's very detached, and everything just sort of progresses in a very quiet way, and I found that fascinating.
It takes a good long chunk, and you were saying earlier that, like, it's funny because you were reading it and it was getting to the point where the light escapes the well and the whole thing goes to shit. And then you realize there's maybe a third of the book left.
Yeah. And, like, he's talking about the mist comes out of the well and all that. I was like, okay. It's still reasonable. It's still good. And it really adds to the ominousness at the end.
Yeah.
But, it's there's a lot of just quiet stuff happening.
And quite gory as well. I mean, it doesn't go into a whole lot of detail, but you can feel that, like, gross mutation. When it talks about Army goes up into the cellar and sees what's happened to the wife, the farmer's wife, and he doesn't hesitate whatsoever. He just shoots her. He just puts her out of her misery.
Does he?
He's the one that gets a shotgun and he shoots her. And he comes downstairs and is like, don't go back up there. I'm gonna go get the cops. Like, I need to explain what's happened. But, yeah, there was no... That thing was not okay. And I don't think it was just ugly or deformed. I think what he was hinting at was that there were lungs on the outside. That this thing was, like, barely struggling to, like, have basic function.
Well, it's the same with Nahum as well. Because when he comes down, he said it's barely been half an hour. And yet Nahum has also been overcome with the greyness, and he's trying to speak to him, but his mouth is slowly sort of crumbling away as he talks.
Nahum's a bit more specific about what happens to him. He does crumble, almost like there's nothing left. There's no moisture left in his body. But what happens to Nahum's wife is far worse.
What happens to Nahum's wife is the slow decay, whereas what happened to Nahum was the light comes across. It's the flash that the Army is so afraid of when the well starts to sort of belch its own light.
It's worse than decay. It's decay and change. Horrible, horrible change. Yeah, so I feel like that paragraph heavily implies that he took a mercy there.
Yes, yes. No, I didn't quite pick up on it, but yes, you're right.
It's really subtle.
It is. He said, I gathered that no moving thing was left in that attic room, and that to leave anything capable of motion there would have been a deed so monstrous as to damn any accountable being to eternal torment. Anyone but a stolid farmer would have fainted and all gone mad, but Ami walked conscious through that low doorway and locked the accursed secret behind him. There would be Nahum to deal with now.
It's really subtle, and I feel like in a different story, Ami being in the house with the mutated Nahums would have been a battle scene. Mm. Even in a horror, it would have been like me and the shotgun and the monsters that they've turned into, and I'm sorry guys, but I have to do this. But it is really just, they say it, they're anything but a farmer. This is a farmer putting down a sick animal.
So to really feed into the idea as well of him just quietly describing things, he says, as it was, he thought only of the blasphemous monstrosity which confronted him. But the terrible thing about this horror was that it very slowly and perceptibly moved as it continued to crumble. There's so little description there, and that is horrifying.
And unlike other Lovecraft stories, it doesn't seem to be putting down the working class at all. It seems to give them a quiet dignity, even though they go through some horrible indignities.
Yeah, it's not racist and it's not classist, so we're going well.
We did all right. We got through a Lovecraft story without any of that. Yeah. It's basically the only one that doesn't.
Yeah, well, it's a good thing we picked this one, eh?
Yeah, well, actually, you picked it. I'm so glad that you picked this one. It's a good good one to start. You're starting off on the deep end, but it's a good one to start. And again, listeners, if you have never read any Lovecraft, or if you've never read The Color Out of Space, it's about 100 pages worth a read.
Yeah, it's very good. I enjoyed it. It's one of those stories where, because it is described so lightly, you're left with this sense of sort of foreboding and, you know, just sort of ominous unease. But if you are squeamish, you can actually get through it pretty okay. Because the descriptions are gnarly, yes, but if you don't have the visual background to back it up, and so you're not someone who regularly watches horror or regularly sort of imagines atrocities, then it's not terrible. It's pretty easy read in terms of that sort of thing.
It's so interesting that you talk about War of the Worlds. In my head, that flying saucers and ray guns and stuff like that, that is so 1950s. I know War of the Worlds was written before that, but in my head, it's just that's the wrong place for that story. It's a shame that that kind of stuff kind of bores me a little bit. Otherwise, I'd say maybe we should do War of the Worlds. To think that we had War of the Worlds, we had that really kind of like laser guns and spaceships. And then out of that, we came into this eldritch kind of horror, this, like I said, Lovecraftian idea of what science fiction is kind of like, yeah, no, there's just things that kind of propel themselves through space. What the hell's a spaceship? And that's way more interesting to me, even though I think War of the Worlds does have things like bacteria and stuff like that.
Not to spoil the story, but bacteria is very important for War of the Worlds. Yes,
I feel like I've seen enough Simpsons episode that explain it so that it's cultural osmosis. I've never actually read War of the Worlds.
It's very good.
you know what? Maybe we'll do it one day.
Maybe.
Now, I was going to ask you, I have a couple of ideas for what we do next episode.
Yes.
I do want to continue on this like this weird sci-fi mix. Yep. And I want to go maybe a little bit more contemporary, but it is a longer book. How do you feel about doing a two-parter?
That sounds good. I'm more than happy to do that. I'll make sure that my microphone isn't shit for both those parts this time.
We have apologies. Had technical details, technical difficulties, but hey, we're a brand new podcast, and it sounds like you, by the looks of our analytics, you guys are still listening, so hey, hope you're enjoying it.
Thank you very much for that, and I will endeavor to make sure my microphone sounds good for the foreseeable future.
These peasants will get what they're given, okay? So I wanted to cover Stanislav Lem's Solaris.
Okay.
Yeah, it is not a very long book, but it's about maybe two, if my calculations are correct. This is our 10th episode. If we do a two-parter, it will lead on to us finishing with our full year.
Nice. That's exciting.
Yeah, so that's a whole year of Strange Library if we get through this two-parter. And I'm sure we will.
And we'll also try and spice things up a little bit, see if we can add some other stuff in, see if we'll start sort of experimenting with things, I reckon. See what we can get done.
Yeah, we've got some interesting ideas. We're gonna slide in some little fun audio recordings and see how we go. We're thinking about changing things up to the main episode format as well, but we're gonna play around with some stuff. You let us know which parts you like and which parts you don't. And if you have any ideas, just put them through to our email. We've got put all that in the show notes. Thank you again for listening.
Or Instagram. DM us on Instagram.
Yeah. I mean, I just called you peasants, but that's fine. We do want your messages. So send them through. Thank you very much for listening to another episode. I am Leroy. You can find me at Double Scuzz on Instagram.
And I am Aiden. You can find me at ShadeP99 on Instagram.
Next episode, we are doing the first 100 pages of Stanislav Lem's Solaris.
Looking forward to it.
Oh, we didn't mention Bloodborne in this episode, but...
Hang on. Before we end this episode, we did a Lovecraft story and not once brought up Bloodborne.
This is...
Wow!
I mean, apart from the idea of, like, people being malleable and beasts changing and stuff like that, it's pretty tangentially related to Bloodborne. There's not a lot to it.
To be fair, it's more Elden Ring than Bloodborne.
Yes. Is it the Crucible that everyone was all beasts and animals all together?
Yep. And the ending of Elden Ring is very, very...
True.
Surprisingly Lovecraftian.
Actually, the final boss is kind of that shiny globule. I'll probably shove this earlier in. But Solaris, one of my top favorite games, Silent Hill 2, there's a lot of Solaris DNA in that.
Oh, see, I've heard lots about Solaris. I am a big fan of Zero Punctuation and Yahtzee Croshaw. Mm-hmm. And so I know about Silent Hill 2 a lot, but I've never played it.
We should do that. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next episode.
See you, everyone.